is Common Sense Radio. Straightforward and no excuses.
All right. Come on now.
This is the Steve Gruber Show.
Call me crazy.
Ooh, yeah.
What I said was perfectly right and spot on accurate.
Boy's got a mouth like a cannon, always shooting it all.
Stop. Yeah, stop. I mean, you're way off script.
Got it in me. Gonna quit until it all comes out.
Hey, boy.
Yeah, you know, it's not cynical, it's common sense.
Pay attention to me when I'm talking to you.
I'm gonna rock the nation.
Genuine, accountable, and raw. Here is Steve Gruber.
Six after the hour on this Wednesday, and good morning and welcome to it, my friends. It's the Steve Gruber Show. Glad to have you along for the conversation. So much to talk about today. The conversation brought to you in part by AmericanMetalRoofs.com. Do it yourself and save 50%. Free classes are offered monthly. Visit AmericanMetalRoofs.com to register and to learn more. I think we'll start right here in Michigan real quickly with a wrap-up of the tornadoes on Monday. The reason being is in Portland, they're still trying to figure out what went wrong. The tornado hit and was gone, and then the tornado, well, the warning never did go up. The message came too late, and it wasn't even a tornado warning when it did show up. Monday's severe storm shared many of the same characteristics of last July's Kentwood tornado, said a meteorologist, Ernie Ostino, from the National Weather Service in Grand Rapids. An area of strong and damaging winds appeared on radar, but only for a short period of time, and by the time damage was reported, the storm had already moved out of the area and on down the road. The reason for not issuing a tornado warning, forecasters say they prefer to see more pronounced areas of rotation across several radar scans before pulling the trigger on a warning. We see a lot of these small circulations, and they are very brief, Ostino said. If we try to get warnings on all of these with lead time, we'd have a very high false alarm rate. These are quick hitters, isolated on the ground for a couple miles, if they're even on the ground at all. Unfortunately, we've had those 2 years in a row now. The survey confirmed that the tornado in Portland was an EF1 with sustained winds of around 110 miles an hour. It touched down northwest of Portland around 2:30 in the afternoon, was on the ground for 6 minutes. And so there you go. I mean, sometimes these storms, even with the best technology, this outbreak of tornadoes caught some by surprise. EF2 is what hit in Saginaw and Tuscola County there. EF1 in Manchester. See, these are pretty good tornadoes for Michigan. Oftentimes we get EF0s. There might have been a fourth one as well, but just bringing you up to speed on why the folks in Portland didn't get a warning, not a fair warning. Keep in mind, if there's bad weather and you think there ought to be a chance for you to go into the storm cellar, you might want to do that. You have been warned. The controversy over the Confederate battle flag flying at the State House grounds in South Carolina, the governor there, Nikki Haley, calling for its removal, being supported by Republicans and Democrats as well. But here we go again. They say not so fast. Could take a while. Under the state's own rules for even touching that Confederate flag, any changes are easier said than done. I would be shocked if there wasn't considerable or even vehement opposition from legislators, particularly from small rural towns, said William Gaston, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institute. On Monday, Haley, surrounded by a bipartisan coalition of lawmakers, called for the removal of that flag. Her comments came less than a week after the murder of 9 black parishioners at a church in Charleston. Renewed efforts to remove the flag gained momentum after images of the killer posing with a flag had surfaced. Here's the problem, though, and I don't think the flag should be there, but it's for different reasons. My reasons are pretty simple. The Confederacy lost the war, and for many years, if you go back and look, it was illegal. It was flat out illegal to fly that flag. The flag didn't even make its appearance on the grounds there at the State House in South Carolina until 1962 as part of a centennial commemoration. It's been there ever since and been a contentious issue. But I want you to think about something else, and that is the folks telling us you can't have the American flag on your shirt because it might offend someone, because maybe on Cinco de Mayo, for example, Hispanic students are offended by the fact that the American flag, they say, represents imperialism. The American flag represents racism. The American flag is an oppressive symbol. Well, Steve, that could never happen. Really? Look around. Look at what these people are doing to your country. But Steve, it's the American flag. That's right, it's the American flag. That some people, well, in Ferguson, Missouri, we see that as a sign of oppression. And on Cinco de Mayo, we don't want, in fact, we're going to send kids home from school if they wear the American flag on a t-shirt, for example, because that might offend our Hispanic students. Well, the day is coming, my friend. The day is coming, I tell you now. Unless we turn things around and turn things around soon, the day is coming where the American flag will be being removed from different institutions so it doesn't offend people. Because people give you this hoo-ha that somehow the American flag is a symbol of racism. The fact is, the American flag is a symbol of hope and liberty and freedom. And it still is today, despite the flaws that America has, and despite the damage being done by this president and this administration, the American flag is still the greatest symbol of hope ever created. Millions flock to America from all over the world every year. More, in fact, than all other countries combined. America takes in more immigrants legally, not even counting the illegals. America takes in more immigrants legally every year than every other nation on the world combined. And yet, there are those among us who would claim that it is a sign of racism, a sign of oppression. So I'm warning you here. I'm warning you here that day is coming. Now let me give you a little bit more of this that I gave you just the other day with this pop-up for us. And that are the quotes from Teddy Roosevelt. There are no rooms in this country. There's no room in this country for hyphenated Americanism. When I refer to hyphenated Americans, I do not refer to naturalized Americans. Some of the very best Americans I have ever known were naturalized Americans, Americans born abroad, but a hyphenated American is not an American at all. This is just as true of the man who puts on native before the hyphen as of the man who puts German or Irish or English or French before the hyphen. Americanism is a matter of the spirit and the soul. Our allegiance must be purely to the United States. We must unsparingly condemn any man who holds any other allegiance. But if he is heartily and singly loyal to the Republic, then no matter where he was born, he is just as good as American as anyone else. The one absolutely certain way of bringing this nation to ruin, of preventing all possibility of its continuation to be a nation at all, would be to permit it to become a tangle of squabbling nationalities. Diversity will be the death knell of this nation. Teddy Roosevelt knew that more than 100 years ago. 14 after the hour on the Steve Gerber Show.
The Steve Gerber Show. Jump starting your day with the news that matters.
It's 18 after the hour. So yesterday, the Senate did a test vote. And the president is on his way to having this fast-track authority for trade agreements. Now, this is the same president, of course, that negotiated the outstanding deal that traded five Taliban leaders for a deserter, Bo Bergdahl. This is the same guy who's working out a deal with Iran that'll give them nuclear weapons, apparently. In fact, the United States and its allies now willing to offer Iran state-of-the-art nuclear equipment. You heard me right. The United States and its allies are willing to offer the Iranian state state-of-the-art nuclear equipment if Tehran agrees to pare down its atomic weapons program. This is part of a draft document that has been revealed. The confidential paper obtained by the Associated Press has dozens of bracketed text where disagreements remain. Technical cooperation is the least controversial issue of the talks, and the number of brackets suggests the sides have a ways to go, not only on that topic, but also more contentious disputes with little more than a week until the June 30th deadline for a deal. However, the scope of the help now being offered in the draft may displease. Congressional critics may displease. This is the way the AP wrote this line. May really irritate people who already argue that Washington has offered too many concessions at the negotiating table. I mean, again, the Republicans are trying to tell us it's a good idea to make a deal with Barack Obama about a secret trade pact, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and other measures here with the same guy who masterminded the trade of five Taliban leaders for a deserter, and a guy who's masterminding a deal with Iran who's telling us to go F ourselves at every turn. The draft, by the way, is entitled the Civil Nuclear Cooperation. It promises to supply Iran with light water nuclear reactors instead of its nearly completed heavy water facility at Arak, which would produce enough plutonium for several bombs a year if completed as planned. Reducing the Arak reactor's plutonium output was one of the main aims of the U.S. and its negotiating partners, along with paring down Iran's ability to produce enriched uranium like plutonium. Outlining plans to modify that heavy water reactor, the draft was dated June the 19th, so just a few days ago, offers to establish an international partnership. Maybe we could put them on the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Maybe they can be part of the deal to rebuild it in less proliferation-prone facility while leaving Iran in the leadership role as the project owner and manager. Man, it just makes you scratch your head, doesn't it? It's just absolutely, it's mind-numbing. All of this that's going on, it's absolutely mind-numbing. Here we are in negotiations, rushing to a June 30th deadline. With no plan in place that anybody thinks is a very good idea, except this president, apparently. He's working on his legacy. His legacy is being firmly established. Make no mistake. If we're going to give basically cash and prizes, here are cash and prizes for the Iranians to make this deal. Cash and prizes for the Iranians to make this deal. And one other thing I want to share with you this morning, just to kind of get you thinking about things. I want you to start thinking about, is gun ownership a sin? Is gun ownership a sin? For the second time in just a few days, Pope Francis went wandering away from the scriptures and into the great unknown. Last week, the Holy Father truly turned the debate about global warming and climate change into the theology most of us already believe it had become. The pontiff scolding world leaders in his writings for not doing enough on what he called an important moral issue. This week, he is wandering deeper into the weeds, the ones apparently blooming in excess these days because of surging carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere. Pope Francis took time to inform those involved in weapons manufacturing that they could not possibly be Christians. They're not really Christians. If you trust only men, you have lost, he told thousands of young people during a rally in the Italian city of Turin. It makes me think of people, managers, businessmen who call themselves Christians, and they manufacture weapons. That leads to a bit of distrust, doesn't it? The crowd applauded, and then he went on to criticize those who invest in weapons, saying, duplicity is the currency of today. They say one thing, they do another. It's not the first time Pope Francis has criticized gun owners and manufacturers. A year ago, he referred to us as merchants of death. I'm a gun owner. Am I a merchant of death, Your Excellency? I wonder if this Pope's political activism is going to take him someplace he wants to be or someplace he'd rather not be. We have reached out, by the way, to the diocese and a couple of places in Michigan, Grand Rapids and Lansing. We reached out to the diocese here, trying to get a response. So far, no response forthcoming. We've had some good conversations with the folks that work there. It's worked out just fine, but so far, nobody here to discuss what the Pope has said and what it really means. So is gun ownership a sin? I ask you again, something for you to consider. The hotline number, 888-900-9966, 888-900-9966. It's Wednesday on the Steve Gruber Show. Feel free to get a hold of us here. You can also check us out online on Facebook, The Steve Gruber Show, stevegruber.com, another place to go, where we post up a lot of the information and the writings that I enjoy so much. And the hotline again, 888-900-9966, Wednesday. We'll be right back.
Steve Gruber Show. Get the news and information vital to your world.
I pulled into Nazareth, was feeling about half past dead. I just need some place.
You know, every time this guy rears his ugly head, you know, I appreciate it, because I think that anybody using, you know, the Gruber name out there, you know, just helps me a little bit. I don't know. I am, by the way, hashtag the good Gruber on Twitter. Just to help you out there a little bit. But Jonathan Gruber, the MIT professor, who gained a lot of notoriety for his comments about, you know, the stupidity of the American voter when it comes to Obamacare, which, by the way, he was right about it seems, because the American voter was buffaloed into buying something that hasn't turned out particularly well. And he had a lot more to do with it now, it seems, than we first talked about. We'll get to that in a minute. But first, when it comes time to make some money, are you proud enough to go in and say, you know, I want some cash? Are you proud enough to say, you know, I'm doing a good job? Because a lot of people, apparently, they'd rather get a root canal, from what I understand. Robin Engton here, the regional vice president of Robert Half in Detroit. And welcome to the program, Robin.
Thank you.
Is it really true? I mean, and this is an interesting conversation, because just not that long ago, I was talking to my cousin, in fact, who owns a large company that looks for accountants around the country. And he says, you know, people are reluctant to come in, and women more so reluctant to come in than men. When it comes time to say, you know what, I've been here for a year or two or five or whatever it may be, and I deserve more money. But it just seems people in general are scared to walk through that door. Why is that?
Well, there could be many reasons that people are uncomfortable, but we found that some of the most fluent reasons or typical reasons are because lack of preparation. So people don't even know what they're worth in the market. Some of it's emotion. Money's an emotional thing, and it can be a sensitive topic for a lot of people. And then some fear the outcome. What if they get told no? Then what are they going to do?
Well, yeah, that's so rough on a lot of people. Yeah, the rejection thing, I think, is, you know, the same reason people don't, they have trouble dating and they have trouble doing it, because they're just afraid of the outcome being no, right? I mean, they hate that. Nobody
Absolutely.
Likes to hear the word no. But why women more, do you think? I mean, at least that was the anecdotal evidence given to me by my cousin, who has 750 employees, and he said, you know, there are people that are less qualified, men generally, that'll come in and say, you all, you know, I need to be paid this. And he'll think, you know, there's women who deserve a lot more. And sometimes they just don't ask for what they deserve. And I wonder why women seem to be a little bit more reluctant, at least from that one incident.
Yeah. No real stat on that, except that with our research, we found that males between 18 and 34 are typically more likely to ask for a raise, and a lot of that comes from confidence with doing their homework and knowing who they are and what they're worth in the market.
Is it possible, possibly from inflated self-worth?
It could be.
Just having some fun there, Robin. I mean, I'm worth this money, and if you don't pay me anyhow. But for a lot of people, it really is a painful exercise. And give me some strategies about what it takes to tell the boss, you know what, listen, I've been here for this much time. You do your homework. I've heard that word a couple of times here. But what's going to be the best route between you and a bigger paycheck?
Well, definitely you need to know what you're worth in the market. That's the bottom line. You have to do a little bit of research to find out what your position pays with the experience you bring to the table. But then on top of that, if you're going to go in and ask for a raise, you need to be prepared. And I say that meaning you need to practice what you're going to say. Don't just go in there off the cuff and try to ask for a raise. You want to think about it. You want to maybe practice with whatever, a significant other or a trusted friend or mentor. And then also be open to options if a raise isn't a viable option. Maybe it's more flexibility in your schedule or more vacation time or something like that.
So flexibility is a key too. And I guess, you know, I'm going to just go out on a limb here and say maybe giving ultimatums probably isn't a very good idea. You might want to be, a team player, I guess, when it comes to getting your raise too.
Well, yes, and you don't want to just jump from a job for the wrong reasons. You want to do it for the right reasons. So you want to think really clearly about if it's no, what will you do next? And, if it's no, but we can do something else, then be prepared to talk about what options you would like to see.
So don't be, but here's the thing, I guess, and this would be true in a poker game or anywhere else in life, Robin, don't bluff unless you're one to back it up. I mean, don't go in there because if you go in there and you bluff and you don't get the raise and you don't leave either, now you're in a really weak position in the office.
Absolutely. People won't think that you're going to do what you say, and they also may think that you have one foot out the door.
So here's, so you said the most likely employees to ask for a raise are men 18 to 34 with 10 or fewer years of professional experience. And, you know, I have, and I said that somewhat tongue-in-cheek about it, an inflated self-worth, but, you know, oftentimes, you know, young employees, well, I could do that better than him, and, I should be getting paid more. I've seen that lots of times. 27%, this is according to Robert Half's Confidence Matters Project, 27% of employees of the Northeast United States would look for a new job if their request for a raise got turned down, which you said. Workers in the South, only 19% would do the same. Employees in the South show the greatest confidence in the stability of their employers, which, you know, you look at the South, though, the South is growing. Places like Charlotte, North Carolina, you know, one of the fastest growing places for, 20 years now. People certainly have confidence in the job market there, don't they?
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
And I think those stats, too, you know, I don't know exactly why they are what they are, but I do agree with you. The South is growing exponentially, and if people are confident in their companies and feel like they maybe are getting paid what they're worth or they're comfortable to get what they deserve, they're going to stay, and they may not ever ask.
We're on the line this morning with Robin Engton talking about how to get you some more money in your pocket. And the first thing is to do your homework, know what your worth is in the marketplace. And if you're worth more based on your experience and your education and so forth, then my God, go in and ask for a little bit more. Now, the company you work for, Robert Half, the world's first and largest specialized staffing firm. So you have locations in, 300 and 350 places worldwide. So you know the job market, not just here, but everywhere. So I guess, just open-ended question. Is the job market a little bit better today than it was 5 years ago, Robin?
It's a really good market right now, yes.
And what are some of the areas, if people are out there listening, say, you know, what are some of the stronger areas? Or if somebody's, you know, thinking about going to college, what would you recommend? We only have about 30 seconds left, but where would you direct people to go spend their time studying?
Well, some of our hottest positions revolve around accounting and finance, as well as in the technology field. And there's others, but those are two that are standouts.
So accounting and finance. So I guess my cousin's in the right place. Accounting and finance is the place to be. And Robin, I appreciate your time. Now go out there and you don't have an inflated self-worth, but get in there and ask for a little more money. Robin, I appreciate
it. Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
It was a pleasure. Thank you so much. Robin Engton, the regional vice president of Robert Half, in Detroit. And first thing you have to do is know that what you're asking for is legitimate, makes sense, is backed up by your experience and your education. Go get them, Tiger. We're all rooting for you. It is 41 after the hour. Welcome to it, my friends, and good morning, Marquette. It's the Steve Gruber Show.
This is the Steve Gruber Show, bringing you the news and newsmakers that affect you most.
Try to see things my way. Do I have to keep on talking till I can go on?
Well, well, well. As I was alluding to here a few minutes ago, Jonathan Gruber was, in fact, one of the main architects of Obamacare. You know, and they said, no, heck, we didn't even know that guy. Gruber? I wouldn't associate with a Gruber. I mean, I've heard that my whole life. But I am the good Gruber. Hashtag it. Figure it out. But our next guest, Michael Doherty, a regular contributor here to the program. It turns out Barack Obama and his cronies apparently misled us, didn't tell us the whole truth. They lied about Jonathan Gruber's rule in Obamacare. And now some saying that the Republicans deserve an apology. Michael Doherty, welcome back to the program.
Good morning. How are you doing?
I'm well. And you?
You know, I'm awake with shock that this was a lie. I can't believe it. I'm amazed.
Yeah, I can barely breathe. I'm so upset over this. You know, they didn't tell us the truth. I mean, well, he was never an employee at the White House. No, he was not an employee at the White House. Right? It doesn't need to be an employee at the White House, boys and girls, to be intimately involved with this process. What's funny, though, is that members of the liberal media actually stepping back and going, oh, maybe we owe the Republicans an apology on this one. Yeah, probably, because it was pretty easy to figure out that this guy was all over the place touting Obamacare, talking about what was in the plan. He had intimate knowledge of how it came together, but what do you think? He got this where? You know, intimated to him from where? Anyhow, so it's interesting to me, the bigger point here is where all of this information is coming from. Information on how this works and information about the inner workings of government, all from leaks and so forth. That's a fascinating part to me.
Well, okay, but let's not give the liberal media too much credit about the apology. That came from the Bloomberg politics. The liberal media is more like, oh, yeah, okay, we'll bury that one, spin, change the subject, move on. Maybe the American public, which we've made so numb to how we operate since the definition of is.
Okay,
we'll
fair enough.
Go on. But, you know, and this is what they're forgetting, which is interesting to me, is technology leaves fingerprints and emails. Are not going away. And, you know, your political machinery can help you with your dirty work. But oversight went and got these emails from MIT. MIT is not going to do your dirty work. So, you know, luckily he didn't work for, a left-wing think tank in D.C. or actually be in the administration. Or they could flush him down the toilet. I mean, these agencies and these little parts of the government, you know, they've got all sorts of tricks. And they'll hire expensive law firms for $1,000 an hour to defend themselves from accountability on our dime. And luckily, these emails came from MIT, and so we don't have to worry about the government lying to us. We didn't rely on the government.
You know, it's interesting that that Assange and these folks become such key players, you know, demonized by many and demonized by the media. And you know, I don't know what my opinion of WikiLeaks was back at one time. But I'll tell you now, if this is the only resource that we have, that you and I have, that journalists have or other people have to get the facts, then I'm all for it. I mean, make no mistake, I'm all for whatever information can get out there, because if the government's going to lie to us, which they apparently do on an all too regular basis about all too many things, then how can I be opposed to them, these guys getting the information out there to me?
Well, that is the danger of a government being seen as a mockery, is that leads to anarchy. But you know what? You have to have anarchy to throw these people out. If the public is going to sit here and take it, if we're going to have so many people in the public be brain dead or justify this stuff so that they can't admit to themselves they made a mistake in the voting booth, you know, we have a problem. And eventually the truth will win out, and the more people they're going to deny what's going on, the bumpier the road's going to be, because, you know, you can't have this. They'll get smacked in the face one or the other, because these are liars. They aren't operating on our behalf. And they're doing a lot of other things that leave us vulnerable.
Well, we know now.
Doing their jobs, cybersecurity being one of them. I mean, these guys are out for their own agenda and their own power. And the next 18 months of the Obama administration is going to be, I think, a very bumpy road, because this guy is going to cram everything he can in before they turn the lights out on him. And then he's going to smash the China if he doesn't get his way.
Well, and here's the thing, though. You look now, and you look at some of these places where the leaks are coming from, and Assange being one of the key players still saying that he is going to release a bunch of information about Hillary Clinton. I mean, if you're Hillary Clinton's camp, aren't you scared to death that he's got his hands on to juicy morsels and pieces of meat that will be dragged out there? I mean, Lois Lerner's, her emails were gone, right? Wrong. All of a sudden, 6,500 show up or whatever it is, and all of a sudden she's back, you know, in the spotlight. But if you're running a campaign today, or you think you could hide something, you can't hide anything. They're going to come get it.
And this is fantastic. This is fantastic, because we just have to hold these people accountable and turn the lights out on them. And how many lies can you tell? The scary thing, though, is you still see these idiots on TV. I mean, I don't know if you saw Rosie Perez on The View. I saw that on the news yesterday about how she's just reading this bullet point list that she's obviously been handed about the wonderful things that Hillary did. Then it gets fact-checked, and it's all wrong. It doesn't matter to these spinners. It's just like what happened at the last 2 months of the Romney campaign. Out came the Obama spinners, and they're, when desperate, they're dangerous. They'll say anything, and we have too many people that are disengaged that get whipped into a frenzy about stupid stuff.
Yeah, but the point being, Michael, though, at some point, something falls on the table that you can't spin away, you can't get rid of, you can't dodge, parry, thrust, return. You know, you can't do that, because fencing is going to be over. And I think Hillary Clinton is the most vulnerable of all the candidates right now.
It's pretty amazing. She's got Deepak and a big machine, but it's the timing. I hope he keeps a lot of the big bombs about this.
I hope so, too.
Until about the heat of the campaign.
About the 25th of October.
Right, because we're already numb already to the server. Like, everyone's got, no one's even reacting to the server, you know. And so she's like, well, look, get it out early. I'm like, oh, no. Just hold on to that.
Yeah, just hold on to it, because the Clinton strategy is always, you know, just wait it out, beat it to death until people are bored with it and move on. That's why you got to leave it till the very end. Michael, always a pleasure.
All right, good talking to you.
Michael Dougherty, everybody. You know, you need to read his book, that's for sure. Michael Dougherty, go find him on Amazon. Great books about cybersecurity and cyber terrorism and all that stuff. 52 after the hour on The Steve Gruber Show.